أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين، ولعنة الله الدائمة على أعدائهم أجمعين من يومنا هذا إلى قيام يوم الدين. My respected Sheikh, elders, sisters, brothers in Islam and Iman, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We have gathered here once again to commemorate the anniversary of the Shahada of the great lady Sayyida Fatima al-Zahra, Sayyidat al-Nisa al-Alameen. There is once a companion of our sixth Imam who asks him this title of al-Zahra, the radiant one. Why is it that we call Fatima al-Zahra? The Imam alayhi salam explains with such a beautiful phrase. He says that when this lady would stand in her mihrab, she had one area of the room dedicated only for her worship. When this great lady, this great mother of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, would stand in prayer in her mihrab, the Imam explains, Zahara nuruha li ahli samai kama yazharu nurul kawakibi li ahli al-arab. Her light would radiate to the people of the earth the same way that the light of the stars radiates to the people of the earth. Her light would radiate to the people of the skies the same way that the light of the stars radiates to the people of the earth. In a dark night, you can see the stars when you go out away from the city, how bright they are. The same way in the spiritual world, the ibadah of Sayyida Fatima would be something that the people of the skies would be in wonder of. It is an honor for us. It is a ni'mah for us to be able to gather together to remember this great lady. Not everyone has this opportunity. And we have to take advantage of the occasion. I remember some years back as I had the opportunity to be walking in the streets of the holy city of Qum during this time period. You know, in such cities, the whole city changes when such an occasion comes. It's not just a matter of one center in one small corner of the city. The whole city transforms. And the environment is one that you cannot help but to be grieved by walking in the streets. And by the way, that is one of the reasons why it is important for us to make the effort to try to come and be present in these gatherings and not just rely on an internet feed. If that's the only thing we can do, then that's better than nothing. But when possible, we should try to come and be in person and participate, because there's so much more than just the words that are spoken. Anyhow, I was walking through the streets and they do a good job of putting banners up. They talk about different aspects of the occasion. This time I happened to come across a very beautiful banner where they had quoted Ayatollah Khamenei, Hafidahullah, regarding Sayyidah Fatima al-Zahra. What he says is the following. He says that Sayyidah Fatima al-Zahra throughout history has been an angel of a savior angel for the entirety of humanity. Meaning, as we go throughout the ages, this one personality has been there for the people who want her to be there for her. And she has been a savior for them. In those words, I found a lot of wisdom and a lot of hope and a lot of consolation as well too, because we are facing difficulties. Typically, there are things that are bothering us, challenges that we're facing, things we want to accomplish. This is the time to reach out and do tawassul to that great personality that Allah has given us. That lady, that Sayyida, and inshallah all of our needs will be answered by her. The topic that we have been discussing has been the following: the tarbiyah of ourselves and our children. Tarbiyah being the process of raising somebody. And we explained how the concept of tarbiyah is not limited to just a parent and a child from the Islamic perspective, but rather everyone is supposed to be on a journey where the murabbi is Allah, and we are like that garden sapling that needs the gardener to come and to remove the weeds and to allow it to flourish into the tree that it was destined to be. We talked about this principle that we have from Islamic sources of prevention before cure. And last night, we began to discuss this particular application of that concept, that when it comes to our exposure to media, how is it that we can apply prevention before cure, and why should we even do so? What is the big deal? What is the harm of being overexposed to media which presents themes and values that are contrary to Islamic themes and values? Now today, with the help of Allah, I want to even go even one level deeper to talk about one aspect of this whole thing. One particular value that you find being displayed in almost all forms of media. In particular, I want to discuss the love relationship. If you look at any movie, whether it be in Hollywood or Bollywood, any TV series, even books, YouTube channels, whatever it is, you find that one predominant theme that is part of almost every storyline in one way or the other is the presence of a love story. In the old days, we were talking about the tales of Arabian Nights. It was the classical theme of a prince and a princess being lost, not being able to find each other, and eventually they come together, or whatever happens. Or maybe sometimes they come together, sometimes one of them dies and they find somebody else. You know, the typical story plot line. They realized that that particular theme, that particular plot line had to be changed in order to keep the interest. Even when they started going with those serials, back from the very early times, it's very interesting if you track the nature of the portrayal of these love relationships in these serials and movies. You find that that theme is there, typically. But how they portray it, they use different variety of techniques. Back at the beginning, in the 1960s, in one of those classical nighttime soap operas that they put on, even from that time, they introduced a character who had tendencies towards the same gender. And at that time, there was a big controversy over that. Now, what it's become today, I don't even know. What the reports that I hear, though, is that even sometimes things you can't even imagine are being portrayed. But what's interesting is that all the time it goes back to the same thing. This idea of two people, or maybe sometimes three people, whatever it may be, falling in love with each other. And this becomes the storyline. This becomes the main thing that occupies the audience as they watch. Is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen? Are they going to get together or not going to get together? What is the relationship going to be like? Now, what I'd like to do is to explore this and try to understand why is it that this particular value is being portrayed so much? Because we have to understand. At the very least, we should be intelligent consumers of what we consume. We should understand, why is it this is happening, and what sort of effects is it going to have if we have repeated exposure to this theme again, again, and again. In order to do that, we first have to look at the nature of the human being. When Allah created us, He created us in a state of utter poverty and need. We are very needy creatures. Ya ayyuhan nas, antumul fuqara'u ilallah. Oh people, you are faqir. You are the ones who are very, very, very in need and very poor. Now, why is that the case? It's the nature of who we are. We can ask ourselves, do we even have control and possession over our own body? If that's the case, then how much have we been involved with the process of the blood circulating through our body and our respiratory system causing us to breathe over the last 10 minutes since we started this lecture? Do we have really control? Is it in our possession? Do we really possess? Do we have those possessions that we have? The cars that we own, the houses that we have, the minds that we use to be able to generate that income that we get? Are these things really ours? If we look at ourselves, we realize that we're very needy creatures. We don't have anything, actually. Everything that we have is being sustained by the one who created them. And the more that we think about what we have, the more we realize that we don't have. And that's why Imam Hussein alayhi salam says, in his dua Arafah, that Ilahi anal faqiru fi ghinaya fa kayfa la akunu faqiran fi faqri. Oh Allah, I am, when it comes to those things that I possess, even in those things I don't really own them. I'm very impoverished and in need of those things. What about, let alone those things that I don't have? Now, that's number one. Number two is that if we understand that we're needy, we understand that we have certain vulnerabilities. There are certain things about us, there's ways that we've been created particularly that can demonstrate that need. We need things. Okay, we need food, right? We need air to breathe. And we need care, we need comfort. The list goes on and on. Number three is that sometimes there are things that can come and pretend to fulfill the needs that we have that are not really what we need. Example, let's say that somebody begins to smoke. Na'udhu billah. They smoke and they smoke and they smoke. Eventually they're going to develop a habit of smoking. Now if you were to ask them before they started smoking, what is the need that they have of that cigarette pack, they'd be like, I don't have any need, I don't smoke. But you ask them some years down the line when it became a habit for them, they'll be like, I can't live without it. And I met somebody like this, where he said that when I tried to stop smoking, I went from being a thin person to basically inflating, and I got very sick and I was near to dying because they took this away from me. I definitely need to smoke. You see how there's something that can come and fill that need that we have that's not really the solution to our need. False solutions to real needs that we have. Now, given that that's the case, those who are aware of our vulnerabilities can make use of them for their own purposes. This is all logical discussion here. And one of those industries that makes use of our vulnerabilities is the movie industry and the TV industry and all those who make media for us to consume. I don't know if you've ever experienced this. I used to do a lot of traveling. And in the plane sometimes, you know, you'd be sitting there, tired, jet lag, closing your eyes, finally they turn off the lights. And somebody next to you is sitting there, and suddenly you hear them laughing. They laugh a little bit, and then they're quiet. And they laugh again, And then they're quiet again. Sometimes they start laughing really loudly. And you're like, what's going on here? Right? You look around like, is there something wrong with this person here? Why are they laughing like this? Nobody is around and nobody's talking to them. They're not having a conversation, but they're just randomly, once in a while, they happen to be laughing and sometimes very loudly and you want to sleep in it. What's going on? And then you go closer and you see that you see the white earphones sticking out of their ears and you realize that, okay, they're watching something. They're watching a show, they're watching a movie, and it's because of that they're laughing like this. Now usually that's where the thought process ends. They're like, okay, yeah, they're watching a movie, fine. I'll have to figure out how to sleep despite the noise. But when you think about it, you realize that there's something going on here. We have a vulnerability. There are certain times when we can be caused to react with laughter. And this person is willingly allowing themselves to be exposed to that and for this vulnerability of theirs to be taken advantage of. Imagine that we had something that could tickle somebody. Like from the member here, we had something, right? Indiscriminate, whenever randomly we could just reach in, like, you know, okay, you're going to laugh now? Okay, here, I'm going to tickle you, right? How many of you would be ready to accept that? That would go against the very fundamental rights that we have. No, I deserve to be tickled when I want to be tickled. You cannot decide when to tickle me. That's something private. But you see how this person, when he's sitting and watching that, he's more than willing to allow whoever is dictating, or shall we say, who is directing that show, to be able to determine when he's going to laugh and when he's not going to laugh. He's taking advantage of that weakness. There's another weakness that we have as well too. I'm just giving you an example so we can understand this even more thoroughly, which is the weakness that we don't like to be bored. Right? We like things to be kind of going on a little bit with a certain pace. I can see that sometimes when we start to belabor a point, how sometimes the eyes start closing, right? Because that's our nature. Our nature is that we were created as hasty. وَكَانَ الْإِنسَانُ عَجُولًا. Human beings were created in a hasty way. Now there's certain reasons why Allah created us this way, but again, this becomes a weakness that can be exploited. Have you ever seen a movie where they don't make things go fast? They make things go very slowly. Usually you don't see that type of movie because that movie doesn't make it to the big screens. There's a reason why most movies are very fast and very action-packed. Because they know that a human being is, they like that. And after all, they want you to like their movies, they want you to like their TV shows. Otherwise, you're not going to watch it. If you don't watch it, they're not going to get the sponsors. If they don't get the sponsors, there's not going to be money made, and so on and so forth. No, there's not going to be any TV show. It has to be action-packed, and things have to move so fast. Now, at the same time that things are moving so fast, guess what's happening? What's happening is that we do not have the power to think over what's happening. Because after all, to be able to think over something, you need some time. Right? If you're presented with something and immediately you're taken to another scene and you're starting there and then you're taken back over here and over here and over here, this is the way they do things. Along with the change in, you know, background and scenery, it takes a while after, we're human beings, right? It takes us a while to adjust to that. We are not able to even think over what happens. Now that's something which is a pretty serious consequence, right? When somebody is able to rob us of the ability of being able to think, well, usually that's something that we would stand up and say, no, that's a right that I must have. If I want to give up my ability to think, then I'll do so willingly, not unwillingly. And we could continue this discussion, but I hope that this point is coming through, inshallah, which is the point that our vulnerabilities can be taken advantage of for certain goals that the producers of these shows want to accomplish. Now there's another thing that's happening here which is very important, which is that through the use of certain devices, these shows are able to take us and bring us into their reality, and we start to imagine that we are part of them. Now this is very important. What's the proof of this? Well, through experience. You might have seen, you know, when somebody watches those types of movies where they do a lot of, like, you know, they take the machine gun and then it's like they start shooting, right? You see that movie once, Okay, you get a bit of a rush, right? Like this American sniper, you know what happened. You know, some people got so much of a rush that they decided to, you know, take some action based on that. But you watch these type of movies again, they don't, usually you don't watch them once, twice, three times, four times. Guess what? Now you start becoming part of the movie itself. You become the American sniper. You become James Bond. You become Rambo. You feel like you're the one who is facing all those enemies, and with such, you know, techniques and such clever sort of thinking, you're able to outmaneuver them. That's the type of imaginary world that they're able to create for us. Now, all of this I've set up and I've been trying to describe in order to go back to this fundamental point, which is that what is the role of portraying these types of relationships, the love relationships in the shows, and what do they want to accomplish? Salatu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. We said that there are certain needs that we have. We're very needy creatures. What need is trying to be fulfilled when they present this type of love between two individuals? Well, it goes back to the need that we have for loving, but loving whom? We were created, all of us, all human beings were created with a desire to love the one who has no imperfection, the one who is all of beauty, the one who is complete and absolute perfection, Allah. All of us have this, and it's something which is absolutely deep-rooted in every human being. The need to love the perfect being, the need to love Allah. And that's something that anybody who studies a human being is aware of, that we have that desire. Now that becomes something that is a strength potentially if somebody uses that desire to get closer to Allah. But it also becomes a weakness that those who wish to exploit our weaknesses for their own purpose can do so. And they can start to present false love. Why is it that this is the one number one theme and number one value in all of these serials and all of these dramas and all of these movies? It's because that is the one number one desire that we have as human beings, to have a relationship with that one divine being, to have a relationship and to be close to and feel the presence of Allah. Now, in order to explain this concept a little bit further, I want to turn to the Quranic example that we have of love between human beings that's termed as false love. All this while, I've been describing this love. I've been using the word love, but from the Quranic perspective, actually this love is something which is considered as false love. Remember, going back to that point, that there are certain things that can come and pretend to fulfill our real needs, but they're not something that we really need. This is one of those examples, the false love that two human beings can have for one another. The example that I want to take is the example of Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam. Nabi Yusuf in the Quran, and the wife of the Aziz, usually we refer to her as Zuleikha, although the more correct pronunciation is Zalikha. Now this is a story which sometimes is misunderstood. Sometimes, because we've heard so many of these fairy tales and storylines and plots, we reduce the story to simply being a story of love between two human beings. It's almost like a prince and a princess story, where there's this great prince in the form of Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam, who's very handsome, and that this lady who is very beautiful, she falls in love with him, but because of various reasons, she's not able to connect with him. After many trials and tribulations, the story eventually ends on a happy note. That lady, her beauty is restored, and she marries Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam, and that's the end of the story. Now, brothers and sisters, if this is the way that we've understood the story of Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam, and I know that many of us have studied this and we learned it, but perhaps some of us may have learned it in this way, this is wrong. This is not the way it actually worked. When you go and look at this story in detail, we start to see a completely different perspective on what is true love and what is false love. First of all, when Allah describes what type of love that Zalikha has for Yusuf, He says that the people, the women of the town, were talking about this. Because word got out that she has this type of love for Yusuf. And the expression that the Quran uses is قَدْ شَغَفَهَا حُبَّ. Now what does that mean? Literally it means that the love of Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam, that he had penetrated into her heart with his love. You see, this is an example. This is typically the way that it is shown on these shows, that there's somebody who falls in love and then that person occupies their hearts. They can't get them out of their mind. They're obsessed with them. This is an example of that. But what happens to this lady? Is this type of love something which leads to success? Is this something which is even considered love? Is this something which Allah looks upon and, oh, it's something which is cute? Let's follow this and see what happens to it. Absolutely not. There is no place for this type of love among people who are believers. It's not cute. It's not funny. It leads to one's destruction. What happens to this lady? She was a queen. She was wealthy. She was beautiful. Everything at her disposal. She was the talk of the town. But the story from the Quran tells us that eventually her lie is exposed. The one who is a slave is the one who is raised to the highest among positions among the people, and she's the one who's forgotten about. When we look at the story of Zalikha according to Hadith, we're told that towards the end, after this whole incident takes place, Nabi Yusuf is imprisoned. What happens is that she's reduced to begging on the streets. This is the result. Failure. This type of false love isn't something that is supported. Failure. She's begging on the streets. That's the end of Zalikha. Now yes, there are traditions which say that there's something that happens after that. According to some of them, what happens is that one day after she's reduced to begging on the streets, she is really suffering. Some of her friends tell her that, okay, why don't you go to the Aziz of Egypt? Nabi Yusuf has now become the king of the land. Why don't you go to him and ask him for some help? It's not a love story. Just go and ask him. You're a beggar, go to one who gives. She's thinking about it. She's inclined to do it. But then some people tell her, no, you can't go. In one narration, she's embarrassed because after all, she was the cause of Nabi Yusuf being thrown into prison, and then after she had accused him of such, you know, like heinous crimes and all that, so she's guilty, she feels ashamed, but eventually she makes the decision. What does she say? That after all, I'm not going to fear one who fears Allah, let me go and see him. She goes and sees Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam. He greets her, and what does she say? She says she praises Allah. She says, praise be to Allah, glorified be Allah, the one who raises the slave to the position of the king and the one who lowers the king into the position of the slave. Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam gives her some advice. He tells her to repent over her past actions. And then at the end, he says that, what is your need? She says that, I am now in an old and decrepit stage. I don't want to die like this. She's found new faith, she's repented. She says that, I want to become young again. And according to the tradition, Nabi Yusuf prays for her to be young. She becomes young, and then according to some narrations, he marries her. This is the way that the story ends. But what takes place in order for Zalikha to receive the status of being the wife of the Prophet? Was it because she liked Nabi Yusuf? Because she fell in love with his beauty, that Allah rewarded her by making her the wife of a prophet? No, we saw that the end result of that was nothing but destruction. It was because number one, she admits to Nabi Yusuf's merits. She says that he's the one who has been raised by Allah. She acknowledges the merit of his taqwa. Number two, It's because she admits her own mistakes. And she says that I am the one, you know, who I've fallen because of what I've done. And number three, she engages in sincere repentance to Allah. This is how the scholars analyze why it is that eventually she did receive that honor, if she, indeed she received it. So brothers and sisters, we have to understand from this story that this type of love is not something that can be supported. There's no place for it. There's another point about this story that I'll mention, inshallah, and then move towards the Masaib. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. This point has to do with Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam himself. That again, sometimes when you look at the story in simplistic terms, we see it in the way that these typical stories are told. That the handsome prince is the one who eventually, you know, becomes the king of the land. Why was Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam handsome? What was it that was special about Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam? In one of his quotes that they have recorded from Ayatollah Bahjad, rahmatullahi alayhi, he describes something about the beauty of Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam. It's something which is very beautiful. He says that in tradition we are told that when Allah created the universe, He took all of physical beauty and He divided it into half. One half of physical beauty He gave to all the physical universe that we see around us. All those beautiful things we see in the forms of mountains and rivers and waterfalls and rainbows and all those other things. All of that is only one half of the physical beauty of the universe. The other half of the physical beauty of the universe, according to this tradition, Allah gave to Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam. So this shows us that Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam was very handsome. He was very beautiful on a physical level. But then Ayatollah Bahjat goes on to say something. He says that, but what one thing which is absolutely certain is that the spiritual beauty of Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam was something that was far greater than the physical beauty of Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam. And that physical, that spiritual beauty is something that every single one of the prophets and the ma'asumeen alayhi salam, all of them shared. How did Nabi Yusuf become a beautiful person? How was he raised into that position that he got to? Why was he the story of the successes of rags to riches? Why was he the one who became rich? It's not because of his physical beauty. It's because of his spiritual beauty that came about as a result of his taqwa. According to tradition, after he became of age, he was in the palace. And many times he was there, and his master, the one who was commanding him, was the wife of the Aziz. For 7 years, he was in the service of this woman. For 7 years, not a single time did he even glance upon her, according to tradition. 7 years is not a small amount of time. But not even one time did he raise his head to even look at her, because he knew his responsibility. He knew he had to preserve himself. He knew that he had to preserve this value of iffah. Brothers and sisters, iffah. This is a value that unfortunately is fast disappearing from the values that we need to possess as mu'mineen. When the Ahlul Bayt tell us how we're supposed to raise our children, in one tradition they give us three instructions. Meaning that all of the instructions that we have regarding raising children can be encapsulated into three. What are those three things? Number one is that you should give your child a good name. Number two is that you teach it, and of course along with that goes, you know, the other teachings as well too, of being a good person, living up to that name which you give them. Number two is that you should teach them how to write, and all those things that go along with becoming educated and learning those skills that we need in order to survive and use this world for good purposes. Number three is that you should ensure that they preserve their iffah. It's such an important concept, brothers and sisters. It was because of the iffah of Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam that he was raised to that station. Now this particular value, we have to look at it and compare it to the type of lifestyle that all this media is calling us to. From the youngest of ages, even in official curriculum that's published by the government, this concept of protecting ourselves, guarding ourselves, is absolutely not present. But rather, the concept and the values that's being pushed is expose yourself, expose yourself, expose yourself as much as you can, as an early age as you can. I'll end with this inspiration that we have from one of our great ulama. There was an alim that you must have heard of. His name is Muqaddas Ardabili. He's one of the greatest of ulama, even until today, when they're talking about different, you know, scholarly opinions and they come to discuss him. They do so with a special sort of reverence. The Muqaddas Ardabili, this is what he had to say about this. When they talk about spiritual statuses and stations, when they come to Muqaddas Ardabili, it's like, no, he was somebody who was special. He's one of those individuals who we know for sure was able to meet with the Imam of the time. He's one of those individuals who was so renowned for his taqwa and for his chastity, for protecting himself when it came to these types of issues, that he became known as Al-Muqaddas. He was known as the Holy One, the Sanctified One. They say that one time he was asked about this point, and he told his students that for 40 years, I have not committed a single action which is mubah. What does that mean? Mubah means something which is permissible. For 40 years, I haven't done anything which is even mubah, meaning for 40 years, everything I've done has been for the sake of Allah. In one way or the other, I made it into something that I know that Allah would be pleased with. It was either mustahab or it was wajib. But it wasn't makruh, it wasn't haram, and not even wasn't mubah. One time, they asked Muqaddas Ardabili, they say that, Muqaddas Ardabili, let's say that the opportunity to present, the opportunity to commit sin were to present itself to you. What would you do in that situation? Now this mountain of taqwa, what does he respond? He says, if I were put into that situation, I would seek help from Allah. Meaning that I'm not strong enough to deal with this alone. Even me, Muqaddas Ardabili, when there's a possibility of falling into sin, I'm not going to rely on myself. I'm going to resort to Allah in that case. I hope, inshallah, that the series of discussions has led us to a firmer understanding of the principle of prevention before cure, and that we can choose a strategy when it comes to media, when it comes to books, when it comes to friends that we take, gatherings that we go to, different events that we participate in, our general outlook on what our role is in this society for ourselves and our children. May Allah accept the efforts. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala al-tahirin. صلى الله عليك يا بنت محمد يا قرة عين الرسول يا فاطمة الزهراء According to a tradition, one time Imam Rida alayhi salam was in the home with his son Imam Jawad. Imam Jawad alayhi salam was only 4 years old. Imam Rida alayhi salam notices that Imam Jawad alayhi salam is standing alone in the corner, lost in thought, thinking about something. After a bit of time, Imam Rida alayhi salam calls his son. He asks him, "Oh, my son, what is it that you are thinking about? Why do I see you in this situation?" Imam Jawad alayhi salam, despite being 4 years old, he responds to his father. He tells him that I'm thinking about those types of inflictions that my grandmother, Sayyida Fatima al-Zahra, had to face. I'm thinking about them. I'm thinking about the injustice that was committed to her. And I'm just imagining that if I had the opportunity to face those who did this injustice to her, how I would treat them and what I would do with them. Imam Ridha alayhi salam goes to his son and kisses his forehead and embraces him and congratulates him for having these types of thoughts. Our imams, all of them, when they would recall the tragedy of their grandmother Fatima al-Zahra, they would begin to cry. Not just cry, they would begin to weep. This is a time when our imams alayhim as-salam must have been in such a state of sadness, remembering what happened to Sayyida Fatima al-Zahra. According to tradition, when Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi passed away, the people gathered in that location in Saqifa. They were busy trying to decide who they're going to pick to lead the nation. Imam Ali alayhi salam was busy bathing and shrouding and burying the body of the Prophet. He goes and he buries him. He returns back to his home. He remains reciting the Quran and compiling the Quran. There comes a point where they've decided. They ask everyone to pledge allegiance to the one who is chosen. But they realize that Imam Ali alayhi salam has not given his bay'ah. They command one of them to go to the house of Fatima. They tell him, go to Ali and tell him to hasten to the call of the Khalifa, of the Prophet of Allah. Qunfud goes to Ali several times and he conveys the message to him, but each time Imam Ali alayhi salam refuses to go with them. One of them becomes so angry, he tells Khalid and Qunfud, gather some fire and some wood. They take that wood and fire and they go to the house of Fatima salamullahi alayha. Fatima alayha salam is standing behind the door. What kind of clothes is she wearing? She is still grieving the death of her father, Rasulullah. We know that she had become very weak and thin at this point. Eventually, he himself comes to the door of Fatima and bangs at the door, saying that, oh, son of Abu Talib, open the door. Sayyida Fatima calls out. She says, oh, so-and-so, what do we have to do with you? Why don't you leave us alone? Let us grieve in peace. He responds and says, open the door or I will have it burnt down upon you. She says that, oh, so-and-so, do you not fear Allah? You wish to enter into my house without seeking permission and you want to assault us? But he is not moved at all. He calls for the fire to be lit and the house begins to burn. He pushes the half-burnt door open. He pushes the half-door burnt open and comes face to face with Sayyida Fatima al-Zahra. The sword is unsheathed and he strikes at the side of Fatima. She screams out, Ya Rasulullah! He then lifts his whip and strikes the arm of Fatima. They find Imam Ali alayhi salam and they throw him on the ground. Look at the tragedy that Imam Ali alayhi salam is left alone with only the daughter of the Prophet to defend him. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he sees what they have decided to do with Sayyida Fatima, he takes his sword and he is about to kill that man, but then he remembers the promise he made to Rasulullah to be patient and to preserve the unity. So he cries out, by Allah who chose Muhammad for prophethood, if it were not the case of the command of the Prophet, you would not have had the courage to enter my house without permission. They call upon
a group of them to grab Imam Ali alayhi salam. They now chained up Amir al-Mu'mineen. They are dragging him to the masjid. Fatima alayhi salam is standing at the door. Qunfut takes his whip now. He strikes her. It strikes her so hard that the same way that a tight bracelet would leave a mark on the hand, it leaves a mark on Fatima. And then he pushes the door, which is half burnt, on Fatima. Fatima alayhi salam cries out, "Oh Rasulullah, look at what they're doing to your daughter." She cries out, "Oh Fidda, come to my help. See what they've done to me. The baby who is in my womb has now become shaheed." Fatima alayhi salam becomes aware in that state of what they are doing to Imam Ali alayhi salam. She tells Fidda, "Oh Fidda, help me. Let me go and pursue Imam Ali. Maybe I can do something to help." When she makes her way to the masjid, she realizes that there is nothing that she can do at that point. She goes to the grave of her father, Rasulullah, and she begins to weep. She tells him that, "Oh Rasulullah, Ali is being dragged and arrested the way that they would drag a camel who is going to be executed. Ya Muhammad, Ya Abul Qasim, Ya Rasulullah, ala la'anatullahi ala qawmi al-zalimin, wa si'alamu al-ladhina zalamu ayyamun qalibin. ينقلبون ما تمام حسين.